and Means Committee, the Subcommittee on Public Safety for Tuesday, May 10th, 2005. This is a hearing, public hearing on House Bill 5042, the Oregon Judicial Department. And I'd like to invite forward Chief Carson, Kingsley Quick, to start the presentations for today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good to see you both.
Good to see you, always. I took the taller chair.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lamont, we are here merely to introduce phase or part two of your program. I would say if there are any questions for either of us at this time, we would try to respond to them. But other than that, I think we'll save you time, and am I not correct? We'll just go to the next one. Do you want to introduce it?
Yes. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator, and as the Chief said, we're just going to move into the next segment, which starts with Part E of the Phase 2 materials, which begin on page 26, and that's the actions to contain costs, improve service delivery, and strategic direction, and we'll move down, and I'll notify you of the sections as we go by those. And then I'll be here as Susan Klosterman, and the Chief will, to answer any specific questions that aren't part of the presenter's portfolios. So, thank you.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations. And as Kingsley said, we are back today to respond to another question that was in the budget instructions that relates to how we are doing at containing costs and improving our service delivery. And before we start that, with me today is Chief Judge Dave Brewer from the Court of Appeals. And before we start that, I had promised the committee yesterday that I would bring you the letter that the Chief Justice had written to the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services Consumer Council about our mental health courts, so I have that.
Excellent. For you. Thank you very much.
Judge Brewer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and Ms. Lamont, Dave Brewer, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. It's a real pleasure to be appearing before you again today. We appreciate this opportunity. Thank you very much. As I was thinking about the remarks I would make to you and the committee today, I was listening to the news on the way to work this morning and hearing a postmortem on the President's trip to Russia and the interactions he'd had with President Putin. And one of the things that struck me is they'd had an extensive dialogue about what democracy means and what the cornerstones of freedom are, is they were both able to agree in principle that having a strong and vibrant and fair judicial branch that's adequately supported is right at the top of the list. And I want to thank you and the committee for everything you're doing to assure that that happens and remains the case in Oregon. So please accept my thanks for that. It's my privilege to appear before you today to talk about some things that are near and dear to my heart, and that's cost containment and improvements to service delivery. I've been the managing judge of the Court of Appeals since late last year. Before that, I was a line judge on the Court of Appeals for 5 years and had the privilege of being a trial judge in the Lane County Circuit Court for 6 years. I also come from a business law background, so saving money and doing the best we can with the resources we have is something that's very important to me. The materials that you have, and Representative Wisnett, good afternoon to you. Dave Brewer, the Court of Appeals. It's nice to see you.
I'm late.
No problem at all. We're at pages 26 of the materials, and my topic today is actions that the branch has taken to contain costs and improve service delivery. I'm not going to go over every single one of these items, but I'd like to hit some high spots with you in the limited time I have available and answer any questions you have. The first example, I think, is one that should mean a lot to you as members of the legislature. One of the things, the challenges our branch has, is the geographical breadth of this state and the need to have resources all over the state. For example, we have major prison sites in 3 counties of the state. 2 of those are in far eastern Oregon. We have a tremendous amount of prisoner litigation in our courts. post-conviction relief cases, parole board cases, and habeas corpus cases. One of the things we need to do is have our judges and our staff appear in those locations as inexpensively as possible. Video conferencing serves that purpose. We have many post-conviction trials that are held right here in Salem, where the inmate is located in a secure location in prison, and everyone else appears by video. We save a tremendous amount of resources doing that. We also have closed-circuit video systems in our trial courts throughout the state to conduct in-custody arraignments and other hearings. That saves a tremendous amount of resources and addresses security concerns in moving prisoners back and forth without at the same time diminishing the due process and fairness that's required in order to conduct these hearings properly. So we're, I think, doing a very good job with the resources we have to avoid unnecessary travel costs, and video does that for us quite well in those areas. The second example I want to talk about is item 1B at the bottom of page 26, and that deals with voluntary mediation programs, and I'd like that discussion to be a little bit broader than our small claims programs. You heard some discussion about that yesterday. I had the pleasure of conducting that program in Lane County, and I can tell you that the community buy-in we got from involving grassroots mediators who had been trained in our community to come in and help settle our small claims case was a huge asset to the courts and building trust with the community. They were able to see a transparent judicial system where cases were handled fairly and efficiently. They were able to help empower litigants to settle their own disputes with the help of the court, but not with the mandate or force of the court. We've always taken the position that a good settlement is better than an unwelcome tried decision where it's fair. And so the small claims mediation system has saved us countless dollars in resolving cases and saving judicial and staff time. The thing you don't see here is the bigger picture as it relates to the settlement of complex civil litigation. And one of the things I can tell you is in small counties around the state, having that three-week medical malpractice trial or products liability case can be a docket buster in counties where there's only one judge. What we're seeing more and more in our branch throughout the state are judges with skills in settlement and mediation of a particular kind being loaned from county to county to help settle cases, again, fairly and efficiently, that otherwise would be huge docket busters for the smaller courts. We're seeing that within courts. We're seeing that outside courts, a particular judicial district, and it is saving enormous amounts of money in our judicial system. Our branch is committed to the fair and efficient resolution of disputes through trial and through settlement. And so those programs mean an awful lot to us. Another example, a smaller example, but an important one nonetheless, is item C at the top of page 27. We have implemented a uniform criminal judgment that's uniform from court to court around the state. It eliminates staff resource time. It's a fill-in-the-blank form where you can still accommodate some individual attributes of a particular sentence, but at the same time get all the basic facts right. That also eliminates needless appeals through errors that are made, that are technical errors in sentencing judgments. And again, that's something that's been implemented recently. In most courts, the remaining courts, it will be implemented by the end of 2006. I'm not going to belabor the wonderful comments you heard from Judge Larson yesterday, except to say that strategic intervention in drug courts, mental health courts, domestic violence courts is a critical piece of a fair justice system. And as you know, because all of you have also been involved with early intervention in children, were involved with domestic abuse and neglect, the amount we spend now to avoid problems and treatment saves us a lot down the road. And our best information, as you'll see in the savings related to action, that a dollar spent in these courts, which is targeted and effective, saves $10 later by reducing recidivism. And we think that's a very important performance measure. Talk briefly about family law facilitation. As you may know, and if you don't, I'll indicate it now, the vast majority of cases that we have where folks come in without lawyers are family law type cases, whether it's domestic abuse, restraining orders, stalking actions, pro se dissolutions. Having people that can, at the court, resources at the court, that can make sure that our pro se litigants get steered to the right location with the right forms to the right judge is a hugely important feature in a fair justice system. If we didn't do that, we'd constantly be dealing with improperly filled out forms with people that couldn't get to the right courtroom. And so one of the things that we do that we think is critical is to meet the needs of our pro se litigating population, particularly in family law, by having resources and information to assist them get through the court process. That's critical to us, too. Some of the other issues, like items F and G, are being used at some level, but not as much as we would like. And they relate to technology issues that we're going to be discussing with you a little bit later today. I won't belabor those now. Another issue, if you turn to page 28, that is a critical piece here, relates to staff interpreters and schedulers. And I know Nancy will tell you that we have POPS package 201 at page 22, which relates to some increased requests that we've made there. As you know, we have so many more foreign languages being spoken in our state and in our courts today. We cannot deliver justice under the statutes that we have without having adequate interpreter services for folks that speak many languages and many dialects of the same language, who otherwise can't be understood. We'll suffer tremendous delays if we don't have adequate interpreter services. This is something we're really focusing on long, strong, and hard. You've got a package on financial services, and again, Nancy can correct me, but it's number 108, which is at page 19. Items J, K, and L relate in some form to that. Their financial system reconfigurations. One of the things we really recognize the importance of is not reinventing the wheel. As where DAS or some other state agency has a financial system or another technology system that will suit us, why create our own? So we're trying to use it where it's efficient to do it and recognize the differences. Item L is important to me. One of the things that's a great challenge in the courts is collecting fines, is collecting costs. One of the things we always have to remember is that the people that have those costs deferred are usually the ones that it's hardest to collect from anyway for various reasons, whether they're prisoners, defendants, or pro ses who simply don't have the money. Having an automated system in dealing with our private collection firms will really help us control those receivables as best we can. So that's something that's also important to us. I was thinking about this presentation, I'm almost done, but I was thinking about how this relates to our performance measures. And as you'll recall in looking at the Chief Justice's recommended budget, I'm not sure you have it in front of you, but we have a report, a special report, which is at tab 10, that shows 17 performance measures that the branch has developed for 0305. And what I was amazed to see is in spite of the budget cuts that we've all been dealing with, over the last several years, that by the halfway point of the biennium, we had met or exceeded 7 of 17 of those performance measures. We were within 5% of our goal on another 4, and that's 11 out of 17. The other 6 are the ones that I've primarily been talking to you about today, where we have plans in place, if we're adequately funded, where we'll be able to get right there on those performance measures as well. The final thing I'll mention to you is judicial education. One of the things we really want to do, too, is to save money on judicial ed, have it be strategic to meet the needs of our judges, and also not to have it be expensive. No boondoggles. One of the things we've learned is that we can save money by having targeted regional continuing education programs. We've done several of those over the last 2 years. Our court noticed, for example, that we were having some problems with our post-conviction cases. A few cases were being reversed. We felt it would be very good for the trial judges to have a little bit more background on certain types of issues in post-conviction relief that they wouldn't ordinarily see in their trial court. So we put on a special program with the parole board on that issue, and we found that that has really helped. We also, because trial judges have to make decisions on the fly, occasionally we'll see an error on admission of evidence or exclusion of evidence. After a 2-week trial, you don't want to see that case reversed because of evidentiary error. So we've had targeted regional CLEs to deal with common evidentiary error problems too. So we're addressing that educational issue. We're trying to get every single one of our judges to a new judge program within the first year after coming on the bench. And we think we're doing a really good job with that, too. And I thank our judicial ed people for that. Now, I babbled on a long time, and I'm about done here. But if you have any questions about these issues, your tabby, I'd be glad to, more than happy to answer those for you.
Can you give us a preview, this is speaking to judicial education, of some of the topics coming up over the next year or so?
Sure. One of the things that we're very anxious to do is to deal with changes in the law that are imposed upon us by other courts. And that, as many of you know, often happens when the United States Supreme Court gives us changes in the law under the United States Constitution. Many, if not all of you, are familiar with United States versus Blakely, which is a case requiring that a jury trial be held at the defendant's request on certain sentencing issues. We're having a targeted continuing legal education program on that at the next judicial conference. We'll continue to have education on Blakely-related issues. One of the other issues that's a critical issue for our trial courts is how to exercise discretion. A lot of the decisions that judges make are discretionary decisions. There's no purely right or wrong answer. How does a court explain its reasoning on the record so that a reviewing court will know that the court considered the right issues and made a decision that was within the range of permissible decisions? Our new judge program in June will highlight that particular issue, and so we'll be doing that. Our new judge program also has a feature on judicial decision making and how judges need to think about legal problems in terms of what the standard of decision making is. That's something that's absolutely critical to get new judges in particular involved in. A lot of nuts and bolts, Madam Chair. We really think that's absolutely critical. It's fun to have the pastry, but we need the nuts and bolts first.
And Madam Chair, if I might add, we have a couple of other exciting judicial education opportunities coming up at the Juvenile Court Improvement Project Juvenile Law Conference in August. We will be doing a program called Foster Care City, where it's an actual simulation of what it's like to experience the foster care system. And last year we did a poverty simulation, 2 years ago, poverty simulation workshop, and you have not lived until you've seen the Chief Justice be the 7-year-old son of Judge Locke Williams. Weren't you seven?
Five.
He was five. But we're really also doing some more experiential training for the judges to really understand what it's like to stand on the other side of that bench and to navigate the systems. We're also doing some training, I believe, at the judicial conference, and Judge Brewer may remember better than I, around mental health issues that we had made a commitment to the Senate President to deliver. So our agendas, while they do have a lot of focus on nuts and bolts, I think are expanding out even further than we have in the past. It's a pretty exciting time.
I might add, Madam Chair, that we have done in the last 2 years a mental health colloquium at the University of Oregon School of Law that the Judicial Department co-sponsored, and Judge Edmonds of my court, Judge Merton of Lane County Circuit Court, and I were on a panel for judges and members of the community on dealing with mental health issues. And so that's something I think we need to repeat in the next biennium, but it is not specifically planned yet. Will be, though.
Very good. Speaking of the Senate President, President Courtney also appointed an interim task force to look at issues surrounding parental abduction. And that task force made some recommendations related to training for judges. I don't have the specific language in front of me, but I would ask you to take a look at that task force report, its findings and recommendations.
Madam Chair, I knew there was another one I was searching for. Thank you very much. That's it.
Okay.
Our plan is to include that training at the State Family Law Conference that we will be planning. Right now we're talking about spring of 06, but that's what the letter to the Senate President was about. Thank you.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to hear that we're moving in that direction. Thank you very much. Additional information?
Madam Chair, members, just very briefly, on page 29 of your notebook, we were asked to respond briefly to how we use professional services and our purchasing and contracts approach, and you will find our brief but inclusive answers there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about those as well.
Comments or questions? Well, again, thank you both very much for your...
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll be turning the program over now. Judge Brewer will stay to Jim Adams, our trial court administrator from Jackson County, to talk about probably one of our most important initiatives that you'll be hearing about, I would say, over the next 5 to 10 years, and that is about our investment in information technology. Thank you.
And Judge Brewer, we look forward to working with you on the parental abduction case.
And I promise you we'll do that. And I would also add, Madam Chair, if there are other issues that you would like for us to specifically have training on, we will do that.
Thank you. We really appreciate your enthusiasm. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members, Ms. Lamont. My name is Jim Adams. I'm the court administrator of Jackson County. And I'm here today on behalf of the former, as a member of the former technology task force, as well as a current member of the technology advisory committee to the Chief Justice and Kingsley Click. Chief Judge Brewer and I will be discussing policy packages 107, 108, and 109. But before I enter into that dialogue, I think that it might be beneficial to have a bit of the history of Oregon Judicial Department's technology in terms of where we began, what we've evolved to this date, to fully understand the rationale for these three program option packages. The OJD has a wonderfully rich history of success in terms of using technology merged with our wonderful staff and judges to constrain costs as well as to improve services. Oregon, as you may know, was the first state in the union that developed an integrated, comprehensive case management system and rolled it out statewide. And remarkably, under Carl Ward's leadership, as well as some of his brilliant programmers like William Jennings, accomplished that task in the mid-80s. For nearly 20 years, OJIN has served our courts and served our courts well. It has provided an effective and stable case management system, and it had the sufficient flexibility to adapt to community-based justice programs as they were created, particularly through the 90s. However, it saddens me to have to share with you that since 2001, OJIN has been in a general state of decline. That's really predicated on two reasons. First is financial. In 2001, our technology division took an approximately 11% general fund reduction. In 2003, a 3% reduction. Secondly, and equally importantly, OJIN, which is based on 80s programming code, is just simply severely outdated. Mission critical components of OJIN today consist of DOS-like coding. If you pardon me, this is one of the few times I've ever used a prop, but DOS coding versus Windows coding. Windows is where you have a drop-down box and you click on a screen and it guides you to a select few options to answers. It provides critical information data entry that's efficiently recorded, as well as it guides the users into consistent application of data entry. We use a DOS system that's basically 4 to 5 digits, alphabetic and numeric. I've removed the OJIN coding from this manual, and this is merely what remains that's based on the 80s system. And this is 7 or 8 point font. There are approximately 47 codes per page to give you a sense of the complexity of this. The consequence of holding on to our 80s technology is that this is, frankly, unnecessarily labor-intensive. It takes my trial court approximately a year with a very gifted and talented staff to train them to where they're operationally sufficient to run OJIN in a courtroom environment. Secondly, OJIN's technology can simply no longer keep pace with the demands of judges, our criminal justice partners, business partners, and the bar. To pull on a graphic that Nancy Miller presented yesterday, I think it beautifully lays out on the kind of the highway, and I'm going to use this as the information highway, that in the mid-80s and 90s, the traffic in terms of the expectations of courts was minimal compared to where we're at today and the demands that we're placing on our technology services. Consequently, the Chief Justice in 2004 appointed a 30-member task force to update our technology strategic plan. It consisted of 30 members on the task force. It was chaired by the Honorable Paul Crawley, I believe, of Hood River.
We met with over 300 community justice agencies. I didn't know there were that many in Oregon, all throughout the state. We interviewed and met with a number of peer states. We brought them in and interviewed their chief information officers, as well as we sought the advice of justice technology planning consultants. We completed our recommendations in March of 2005 and presented them to the chief. In general, they consist of three overarching and pretty dramatic shifts in the way we manage technology. First and foremost, we want to shift our business model towards an electronic paperless court system. If you just reflect momentarily, every time a piece of paper enters my trial court, we either create a file or pull a file to enter that document into the hard copy file, as well as frequently there's an OGIN entry as well. A paperless court, an electronic court, would allow for electronic payments, which would minimize data entry errors, increased financial accountability in the systems management, as well as enhance public services. All of these are consistent with the themes of constraining costs and improving services. E-filings and web-based archival records would follow suit as well. I almost am fearful of having to describe to you at some point the workflow process of pulling an archival record in Jackson County, when in fact we have to take that same record and make a copy of it for microfilm, microfiche archival purposes, which is about the same labor requirements as digitizing it. If it were digitized, we could hang it on the internet, make it available to the public 24/7, and significantly reduce archival records retrieval cost. A second overarching theme, in addition to moving towards a paperless court, is to move towards what I'm going to refer to as a modular-based software concept, and this has two components. In the 80s, when OGIN was developed, and OGIN, for a metaphorical description, is the interface between the user and the electronic data. That model in the 80s, in kind of the state-of-the-art coding that created OGIN, is basically a self-contained and very intertwined type of program. It's very difficult to tease out any single component, as well as it's very difficult to add components. It's not subject to modules being added. The analogy is if you were to be looking at a phone system, you would start with the base phone system, and dependent upon the user's needs, you would purchase what kinds of special features you need: call forwarding, conference calling, caller ID, even web-based calling. The concept is through modular software design, the user can purchase those requirements that they need and leverage economic incentives, as well as expedite the employment of the software to meet justice needs. Within that concept of recreating OGIN and bringing it into current language and coding, we're going to have a dramatic turnabout. Historically, the Oregon Judicial Department has created our own software internally. In the future, we look to continue to create software internally, but to outsource the majority of it. Over the last 4 to 5 years, the IT market has changed substantially to where it's hard to justify the design of all software internally. So if we're able to create an environment where we can add modules, we will look to outsourcing it in one of three ways. First, we'll look at it for off-the-shelf third-party vendor purchasing. Secondly, we'll try to work towards large national software developer public-private partnerships where we provide the expertise and kind of the systems requirements as well as the beta testing component. The vendor creates the product, they sell it nationally, and we get a greatly reduced or at no cost. The third concept is to develop peer state partnerships and to develop software that can be used across state lines. The third and the final overarching theme is we've streamlined and made more efficient our IT governance. In the past, we had multiple advisory committees and committees that had parts and pieces of the IT process. Those have, by and large, been disbanded and folded into a single governance committee. We're going to use a portfolio-based form of governance in which we can carefully track at every stage of development cost. We will carefully prioritize commitment to all strategic IT programs and major purchases initiatives. Additionally, the task force made 22 discrete IT project recommendations to the chief to be funded, as Nancy shared with you, over the next 10 years. They have been done in such a manner as to take advantage of funding opportunities, to offset costs among partners, to create a dynamic and flexible IT environment, and consistently move our state towards our stated goals. Chief Judge Brewer and I are here today requesting authorization for funding of three of these POPs that are we consider mission critical at this time. I respectfully refer you to page 19 in your package on policy option 107. The first of these POPs is in the amount of $2,760,268. That's a capital request, not staff. It provides for modernizing our security system that's necessary to comply with Homeland Security requirements. As Chief Judge Brewer said, a lot of this is really nuts and bolts. It is literally computer electronic switching devices, routers, servers, etc. Secondly, we hope to purchase a number of workstation PCs and printers that are capable of running the very kinds of technology that were just mentioned about GUI OGIN. Yes, as Chief Justice Brewer mentioned, a number of courts are very effectively and incurring efficiencies out of the rollout of GUI OGIN. But unfortunately, a number of courts today remain outside of that capacity or that ability simply because they don't have the necessary computers and computing powers to take advantage of those opportunities that exist today within our own department. And finally, within that package, we hope to replace a number of antiquated analog tape recording court systems. I can give you very painful experiential dialogues about one of my finest court clerks inadvertently erased a tape during a capital punishment sentencing that resulted in the death penalty because we were using an analog tape recording system. And the migration to digital recording systems will both constrain cost and have a number of safeguards to prevent future episodes like that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chief Judge Brewer for the second of the options.
Jim, I'm going to focus, if it's all right with you, on package 109.
Judge Brewer, yes. Before you go forward,
very
Representative Hansen.
Sure. Question. Could the cost of that package be financed with COPs or a longer-term form of...
We'll have to double-check. My hesitation is I'm not sure how that works with a separate branch of government, so I would need to double-check on that. Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and continue. Moving on to policy option package 108, page 19. That package is a request for personnel in the amount of $683,398 during the 05-07 biennium, or 4.15 FTE. That will have a roll-up of 5.0 FTE in future biennium. The rationale for the reduced amount during this biennium is in order to prepare for this staff and hire and recruit them and get them on board, we're figuring a startup date of November 1. This proposal is a direct result of the 2003 legislative action in which we had a budget note that requested us to complete a financial systems analysis. We contracted with an Oregonian accounting firm, AKT, to assist us in that process in which a number of financial systems recommendations occurred. We have implemented those recommendations within existing resources that we were able to, but there are three key components that we simply cannot implement without additional staff resources. And those are, one, to implement e-commerce. As I mentioned earlier, we feel as if we can incur substantial cost savings in the future as well as provide greater security, if you will, in terms of transactions and accuracy in terms of data entry, as well as customer service through the implementation of e-commerce. As Chief Judge Brewer stated, every effort will be made to shirt-tail onto the DOS system. We certainly are not trying to create our unique own pathway. There are 2.83 positions in that subcomponent. One is for our actual FASD, our Financial Services Division, and one is for our Technology Division to support the programming. Secondly, the Financial Systems Review recommended that we provide regular and ongoing financial systems training. Currently, we have no resource to do that. I think the last training that I recall, I believe, was in the early 90s. And unfortunately, what happens in trial courts are we self-train. That's what we have to deal with. And so if you do not have, if you currently have a practice that's not appropriate or is problematic, we continue to repeat that same and train that same to future employees. Secondly, we don't know best practices from one court to the next. And by creating a financial systems training capacity, we feel that we could much better meet the financial and accountable needs in that area. And last but not least, the systems review really identified a key problem in the financial area, and that is we're woefully shy of adequate financial policies. Again, the nuts and bolts of daily operations. And even the few policies that we have often intertwine policy and process, which make it very difficult administratively to tease those issues out. So with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Dave Brewer from the Court of Appeals. I'd like to briefly chat with you and the committee about Policy Package 109, which as expanded is covered at page 24 of your materials. And to piggyback a little bit on some of the things Jim said as it relates to an appellate case management system. And as you can see on the second bullet point under item 6A, that is estimated to be a $1.5 million package. Remember what Jim just told you about the OGIN system. It was a great system when it was originally devised back in about 1983, but it's a trial court system that's 22 years old. Well, what I'm here to tell you is that's what we use to manage our appellate cases. It was never designed to be an appellate case management system, but it's the interface that we use for our record keeping in the appellate courts. That has presented many challenges over the years that have kept us from realizing the full capacity of a case management system. First of all, although OGIN has been described as a case management system, and at some level it is, in many other ways it's more of a case register because it's very difficult to work with, that is, manage the data from it. It doesn't lend itself to sortable databases. So, for example, if I want to know where the plugs are in my court, where the work needs to be getting done faster, I want to know how many motions of a certain kind have been filed in the last month and how long it's taken them to be resolved, I can't manipulate that data effectively on OGIN. What I have to do is to devote staff resources to do a tremendous amount of that work manually. That interferes with our ability to determine the most efficient practices in our court and whether we're doing our job as well as we think we should be. So there are problems with the lack of a sortable database that is specifically designed so that we can pull out certain kinds of reports, whether standard reports or reports that we need on the spur of the moment. And there is the issue of compatibility with the court's practices. So, for example, calendaring is very different in the trial courts for court appearances than it is in the appellate courts. When I first looked at OGIN in the appellate court system, having been familiar with it at the trial level, I saw a completely different set of motions, for example, or activities or record types in the trial court system that are not applicable to the appellate court system. So we'll have codes in our OGIN system that don't have anything to do with appellate practice. And getting the resources to change those codes to work in our system is a very difficult and expensive process. So the interface is more of a register than it is a case manager, and it applies to trial courts rather than appellate courts, and it makes it more difficult for us to come here and tell you, A, what the proper performance measures are, and B, how we're doing in relation to those measures. So we do think that this is a critical component to add as a policy option package this time.
Jim? Just simply in closing, when OGIN was created, there was no Internet. There were no drug courts. There were no family courts. Methamphetamine was not the challenge that it is today before all of Oregon. And simply, we didn't even have terminology or concepts of service integration. In fact, even courts were not even, at that point, considered responsible to be the collector of fines and fees. And there was great debates between the judiciary as to whether or not that didn't constitute an ethical violation. The changing judicial environment has been substantial since the mid-80s. And if Oregon is to continue to meet the challenges within our court system of cost containment as well as improve public service, it's imperative that we then now make investments in OJIN now and into the future to move from this technology into the current and future technologies. I want to thank you for your time. You've been very attentive and very supportive through this process, and would open it up to any questions that this committee may have.
Thank you, gentlemen. Comments or questions? Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now, we also have Mr. Ward. Was Mr. Ward going to comment for the record? Okay. All right. Then I believe we are ready to move on to public testimony. And we have quite a remarkable lineup here. I'm going to call up the first panel to discuss overall court support. That panel includes Nina Cook, Oregon State Bar, the Honorable Robert Wolheim, Judge, Court of Appeals, who also chairs the Access to Justice Committee. And good afternoon to you both.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Lamont, my name is Nina Cook. I'm president of the Oregon State Bar, and I practice law in Portland, Oregon at a law firm called Sussman Schenck. I'm here today to testify in support of the Judicial Department budget. One of my colleagues from the Board of Governors will be here on Thursday to testify in favor of the Public Defense Services. I want to first start my remarks by thanking you all. As I've tracked the progress of the budget coming out of the co-chairs, it seems evident to me that the committee really does understand the central role the court plays in our community. Most of the other critically important budgets you grapple with, anywhere from law enforcement to economic development budgets, are dependent on the courts and the work they do for all of us in the community. The OJD budget has always been relatively lean, and to the extent there was any fat in it within the last few years, that certainly has been cut out. It also is lean because it doesn't factor in the caseload growth, the new staff or programs, and our technology advancements. The Chief Justice has proposed a budget that is designed simply to keep our doors open and to keep civil cases moving on through the system, and that also keeps criminal cases moving at a pace that is acceptable to our community. Last year at this time, you will recall that Oregon got a wake-up call. We had a chance to see firsthand what happens when our courts are not adequately funded. When the system essentially broke down, the impact of the community level was palpable and indeed measurable. Even though the courts did an admirable job of prioritizing to keep moving on a high level, there were many violent crimes, including shoplifting, felony car theft, and small claims, which were sacrificed. The bottom line impact on small businesses, community economics, and quality of life was significant across the board. Many of our communities measured sharp increases in felony car theft and shopping. Some criminals were actually quoted as saying that they understood there was understanding that there was a temporary safe haven. Meanwhile, the small claims system, which is so dependent on our courts, actually came to a halt and significantly impacted our business. The good news for the courts is that I think as a community we learned something last year. When we hear the words public safety, I think most citizens tend to think about law enforcement and our jails, crime labs, district attorneys, and the fraud units. And while it's true that their work is a critical piece of our public safety system, it becomes meaningless without the support of our court system. What we learned last year is that courts play a central role in public safety and one that we cannot afford to undermine. As the state wrestled with what became a public safety crisis, it was encouraging to see the courts at the front line of that dialogue. This brings us, of course, to the present and the new biennium and a new opportunity to restore the court's ability to serve the community. As you consider this budget, I hope it's helpful to consider the courts in the context of three primary service areas for Oregon. I understand there will be three separate panels that follow our testimony that will outline and speak more fully to these three. The first service area, of course, is ensuring public safety. This is the obvious one. Processing violent crimes, drug crimes, property crimes has a direct correlation, of course, to the quality of life of all Oregonians. The second primary service area relates to protecting children and vulnerable members of our society. These include emergency protective orders, both for domestic violence and elder abuse. It also includes another area that tends to suffer, and that is in domestic relations, divorce, and custody, and child support. Those are all crucial pieces of our court system. And the final context in which I hope you can consider the courts, of course, is in sustaining our business community. My practice is exclusively commercial law, civil litigation, and I can tell you that is vital to my clients and other businesses in this state that we have a courtroom and a court system that is operating efficiently and effectively, and of course one that has its doors open. I think we can take great pride in knowing that over the history of Oregon courts, we have seen cases resolved relatively quickly compared to other jurisdictions. And I certainly hope for the sake of my clients who are small and medium-sized business owners that we can maintain the civil practice and the important things that the courts do on the civil area. As I said earlier, I am encouraged by the indications that the legislature sees the courts for what they are, which again is an integral part to our public services and other areas funded by this body. As we face these crises the last few years, I have been struck by the irony of what is happening globally, and the judge commented on it earlier, and that is, as new democracies, of course, spring up around our world, the first order of business is creating their constitution and the independent judicial system. Yet we have what we consider the greatest system in the world, and sometimes it's very difficult to fund something so fundamental. By way of information, we have many of our Oregon State Bar members who are assisting in those foreign countries on the front end of assisting those governments in establishing their court system and their constitution, so we're very proud of our Oregon lawyers there. And again, it seems like we really do need to avoid the temptation of forgetting about the fundamental system that we have that really is the cornerstone of our democracy here. What it really comes down to is providing a place for our citizens in which their disputes are heard and adjudicated fairly and consistently and impartially. It's also very important, of course, to victims of serious crimes that they have their day in court. In respect to the question raised by the chair on the Parental Abduction Task Force, I can report that both our family law section and our criminal law section will be addressing those issues at their fall and spring CLE, their legal training seminar, so there's that update. I just would like to thank you all for inviting me to be here with you today to testify on this very important topic. The Oregon State Bar is standing ready to help and assist you in any way. Any information we can provide on the Oregon Judicial Department, I'm happy to help. So thank you very much for allowing me to be here.
Thank you for those excellent remarks. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, Representative Hansen, Ms. Lamont, as the chair indicated, I'm Bob Wolheim. I'm a judge on the Court of Appeals. And as also I am chair of the Judicial Department's Access to Justice for All Committee. And as the chair knows, he's also a member of that committee. I'm going to talk a bit about the overview, and that following me, there will be others that will talk about more specifics of the three pillars. But as the Chief Justice has said repeatedly, the courts are the backbone of our judiciary. And I would add that it is the rule of law that holds that backbone in our society together. And it's the rule of law that I must come back to often today, because everything does come through our doors in one form or another. We have the three pillars about protecting vulnerable citizens, ensuring public safety, and sustaining business. And they are all, likewise, all have to be addressed. And I think the rule of law addresses all of those. Because my understanding of the rule of law is it's really quite simple. All people are treated equally. The courts must treat those people with respect. They all are entitled to their day in court. And they all must feel as they leave the court that they've had the opportunity to tell their story. And most importantly, that the court listens. For some, it may even be that allowing them to have their say in court might be more important than prevailing on a specific issue or not. And I think, lastly, the court personnel must reflect the faces of all Oregonians who use the court, whether they're parties in action, witnesses, jurors, victims in criminal cases. The court system must reflect that face. Now, I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of the performance measures they've been referred to earlier. As one of those has been talking about accessible interpreter services, having the representative workforce, as well as the quality of self-representation. We've had some success, and we are working quite diligently on the issue of interpreter services and forms. Let me give you just one example. If you go to our website and click on forms, and then you can click on the Family Abuse Prevention Act, you'll see that those forms are available in Spanish, Korean, Russian, as well as English. And there's works to add Vietnamese as well. We are also working on making sure that the signage in courts is appropriate for the people who use those courts. In terms of personnel, the Access Committee has worked with the Personnel Division in terms of not only evaluating who are applicants, but looking at that data, where people come from, where we can be more successful. I'm not going to discuss it in any detail, but in your notebook, Exhibit 5 is the Access to Justice Diversity Focus, which talks about some of these issues. But let me specifically talk about some of the work of the Access to Justice Committee. We work through the subcommittees, such as workforce diversity, education, monitoring and evaluation, and some legislative work. Some of our successes, and we've had successes as well as failures, has been we with others, including the bar, made some suggestions, proposals in terms of mandatory continuing legal education requirements concerning the elimination of bias. We have been successful in those efforts, and those are now part of the mandatory requirements for all lawyers in Oregon. As has already been mentioned, there's training for new judges. I believe at the upcoming training in June for new judges, there'll be some discussion about it, just a bias-free courtroom. We've had presentations, as indicated, at the Judicial Conference and at the annual Juvenile Court Improvement Progress. Some of those presentations have included First Do No Harm, Distortions and Consequences of Race and Class in the Courtroom. Second, the Indian Child Welfare Act Checklist, Child Protection on the Reservation, Working Effectively with Interpreters in a Legal Setting, and lastly, Ensuring Access to Justice. We look at it as a quite broad, I guess I probably would say, responsibility that we have. The courts really are the most conservative of the three co-equal branches of government. I know some may disagree with it, but we really are. And what the courts are about is predictability. People want to be able to organize their affairs so they know what's going to happen in the future, whether it's businesses or individuals or whoever. And the rule of law requires that we're going to be predictable. We're going to treat everyone the same, treat the situations the same, so that people can make decisions on their life. Because the goal for most folks is to avoid the courts. And if they can guide their lives in that manner, they will be happier, as will we be. But without that equal treatment, there is no predictability. I wanted to mention one other thing about the rule of law. I was up for re-election last year, and as I traveled around the state speaking to Oregonians, especially young Oregonians in high schools, I would be asked continually the question, well, wasn't the court really creating special rights for this group or that group? And part of it, I felt like a civics teacher saying, no, what we're talking about is everyone that gets treated equally. And what I pointed out to these high school students primarily is that in the United States, probably by 2020, there will be no majority, and we all will be minorities. And probably by 2040 in Oregon, again, we will all be minorities. And at that point, the rule of law, which and all that entails, that requires that people be treated equally, will even be more important in guaranteeing our freedoms and our liberties. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them, as would Ms. Cook. Otherwise, we can continue with the others in the presentation.
Comments or questions? And thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Chair.
It's good to see you. Thank you. The second panel, under the topic Vulnerable People, includes the Honorable Stephen Tickton from Deschutes County, Julie McFarlane, Juvenile Rights Project, and they will be followed by Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center and the Honorable Paula Brownhill from Clatsop County. She is not. Okay. I understand that Paula Brownhill is unable to be with us, and so we will, from the three of you.
Good afternoon.
Please begin.
Senator Gordley, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. I'm Steve Tickton. I'm a circuit judge from Deschutes County and former Bend. And I'm pleased to be asked to come here today to talk about efforts of the Oregon Judicial Department on behalf of vulnerable people. I can say first, without hesitation, that it is a statewide orientation of the Oregon Judicial Department to provide quality services to vulnerable people. It is the Oregon Judicial Department is heavily invested, of course, in providing appropriate outcomes for immediate issues that face the court. But we're also heavily invested in long-term lasting solutions which minimize opportunities for future victimization, teach skills and change thinking and behavior patterns for long-term success. We're doing that in a variety of ways, and I wanted to spend most of my time talking about treatment and problem-solving courts. Perhaps Ms. McFarlane, for instance, will talk about the Juvenile Court Improvement Project, which helps teaches judges how to better deal with juvenile dependency cases, or the Citizen Review Board, which evaluates the work of the courts and the Department of Human Resources in dependency cases and makes useful suggestions. But I think that the treatment courts and the problem-solving courts are of great interest now. Most courts in our state have chosen to implement some form of treatment or problem-solving court, and some have chosen to implement several. There are a variety of ways to structure problem-solving courts, and I think Judge Larson spoke yesterday about drug courts. But I think generally it can be summed up in this way. They involve the intensive and regular judge participation with the case, and it's the same judge every time throughout the duration of the case. They also involve collaboration, cooperation, and coordination between the court and the various partners with whom we work in the community, such as treatment providers, the district attorney, sheriffs, county mental health, parole and probation, and state agencies such as DHS. Now, 21 is judicial districts. I don't recall, the chief can inform you, I'm sure, or me, about how many judicial districts there are, but 21 judicial districts currently.
27.
So the vast majority of judicial districts have chosen to implement these kinds of courts. By far the most prevalent is the drug court, which is found in 18 different judicial districts. And while we're on the topic of vulnerable people, I think it's important to point out that most of the people I see, or many of the people I see that have addiction issues and are before me for criminal prosecution on drug cases are also parents. And it's also clear that the most pervasive issue that cuts across almost all of the juvenile dependency, abuse, and neglect cases we see is parental addiction. So I think we should, I would encourage you to look at drug courts as a service for vulnerable people in our communities. There's one DYI court. There are six domestic violence courts, and maybe Ms. Hebb will address those issues. There are 10 family courts. There are 2 family drug courts, 9 juvenile drug courts, and 5 mental health courts. In our county, we have a substantial experience with these kind of courts. We have, I believe we had the first integrated family court in the state of Oregon. We've had that for over a decade now. Representative Wisnant, I think, is intimately familiar with what we do there from his days as the chair on the Deschutes County Commission for Children and Families. But basically that plan is, again, we have one family, one judge, where we use one judge handles all matters involving all members of the same family, and we define in our county family very broadly. And then second, the other piece of that is we have a family advocate who puts together a package of coordinated services for these people so that they can be successful in the real world in the community. The other thing that we do in Deschutes County is we have a mental health court that we've had for a couple of years. And I think that's an area that's gaining increasing interest among the various judicial districts. It's showing a lot of promise to be successful, and our county, I think, is an example of that. It's also a good example of how we can collaborate with our community partners to do a better job for people. In our county, the impetus for starting a mental health court was NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And the coordinators or directors, I'm not sure what their title is, in our county came to me and they told me that they had an adult son who had been variously untreated or mistreated by the criminal justice system in 2 states. Fortunately, neither was Oregon. I believe they talked about Idaho and Arizona. We also at the same time had a sheriff that I was in regular contact with as the presiding judge, and Sheriff Stiles was well aware of the fact that he had a jail full of inmates, many of whom were suffering from mental illness, and many of those people didn't need to be in that jail. They just had no place else to go. So we put together a team. We involved the district attorney, the public defender, the county parole and probation office, the Deschutes County mental health department, and we created a mental health court. We call it technically the deferred sentencing program, but the function of the court's somewhat broader, and that is to manage people with mental illnesses in the community rather than incarcerated. What we do is we try to identify very early on those people in the Deschutes County Jail who could be released into the community if they had some services without endangering public safety. Then we offer those people a choice between incarceration and treatment. Or some of those people we actually offer a choice because many of these cases we're using in mental health court are misdemeanors, for which they could plead guilty and get a sentence of credit for time served. But we're offering them, instead of nothing or offering them treatment again. So we know that if the only two alternatives are incarceration or nothing, that we'll see these people again and again. They'll be back filling up the beds in our jail, and they may be back filling up the more expensive, even than that, beds in the Oregon State Hospital. What we do is we create a transition plan for them so that we know that the moment they walk out of the doors of the Deschutes County Jail, where they're going to spend the night. We don't want them going back to sleep in the Deschutes National Forest or in Drake Park. They know where they're going to go get their medication, and we put together a treatment program for them so they know what they're going to be expected to do. We then set the case over for a year, and at the end of the year, if they successfully participate in the program, the charges are dismissed. Now, one of the features of this court, and frankly, we're not trained in law school or even when we become judges to a variety of issues. One of the things I was unaware of was the effect that the judge can have in keeping these people on track. And the same model applies to drug court as it does to family court, as it does to mental health court. I see these people, and it's always me, they always see the same judge. I see these people periodically. The frequency is dependent on the nature of the person and the progress that they're making. To kind of complete the story, the people that had come to me to encourage us to create a mental health court, their son ended up being arrested and becoming a participant in the mental health court. About 30 days ago, he graduated from the mental health court, and his parents, the two NAMI folks, came to our local public safety coordinating committee meeting, and I had the pleasure of watching them tearfully tell the committee how the mental health court had turned their son's life around. So it's not just the things we're doing in Deschutes County. That's just an example. As I've said, we have 21 different judicial districts that are doing a wide variety of sorts of things. I guess the only other point I'd like to make about these sorts of efforts is that they don't come without a price. They're extremely labor-intensive for judges and judicial staffs. They require a lot of concentration, focus, and intensity for a prolonged period of time. We think they're worth it, and I'm sure that you'll see the Judicial Department continuing to operate the programs that are now being operated and expanding them in the future.
Judge, how long has that program been running in Deschutes County, the mental health court?
I'm going to say we probably started working on it about 4 years ago.
Okay.
It took us a while to get it up and running. We originally got a grant, and the grant enabled us to operate the program, but we had very limited parameters. We had to have co-occurring disorders. There had to be an addiction and a mental disorder, and they had to meet certain criteria. I personally felt that the criteria were too stringent, and we weren't serving enough people. And I can say that on a almost monthly basis, we expand the criteria to meet the existing need.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on then, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be sure that you understand, and the committee understands, that the leadership that the judge provides in our community. I've worked with him for 6 years, and he was the governing director of the Commission on Children and Families. He's not been afraid to take chances, but it's all for good public safety and for our communities, and he's a real leader in our community in prevention and trying some different things. So we're glad to have him in our community.
Thank you very much, Representative Wisnot.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Gordley, members of the committee, my name is Julie McFarlane. I am a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the 18 attorneys at the Juvenile Rights Project. We represent children in juvenile court and in the child welfare system. I have been doing that for 28 years. I'm also a foster parent and have been doing that for 9 years. And so I'm aware of the importance of the juvenile court to the protection and safety of abused and neglected children. The courts, the juvenile court plays an essential role in the protection of abused and neglected children. First, no child can be placed involuntarily in foster care for the child's protection without the involvement of the juvenile court, and that is because of the constitutional right that children and parents have to family integrity and the due process requirements that must be met in order for that right to be interfered with. But beyond that initial placement in foster care and the process of adjudicating whether or not the child should remain in foster care or be returned home, the court, the juvenile court, plays an important monitoring role. That is a role that really has been imposed upon the court by Congress. The federal government over the last 15 years or so, and particularly with the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and that was because Congress saw the need to have the court in a monitoring role to assure not only that children were safe, were appropriately being brought into the child welfare system, but that they remained safe while they were in the system, and that they had adequate opportunities to either return to their parents and be reunited with their families or to have a more permanent alternative placement such as adoption. And so the courts now play a very important role, and that takes, again, a significant amount more time than we used to spend on these cases, which used to be pretty much over once we had had the adjudicatory trial. Now courts are very much involved in monitoring and having regular review hearings, and in fact federal law and state law require that these cases be reviewed approximately every 6 months. The citizen review boards are volunteer panels that assist the court in meeting that obligation. They are an asset because they involve volunteers in the community in the juvenile court, which is also something that we have not had a lot of prior to the involvement of the citizen review boards. So they are perform an important function and help the court to maintain the safety of children. As you all are aware, there have been a number of high-profile cases recently that have demonstrated the need for this ongoing monitoring by the courts and the CRBs, and the very important nature of that protection. Ultimately, of course, the court is the decider of whether or not parental rights will be terminated and the child will have an alternative permanent placement. The Juvenile Court Improvement Project has been also a great asset to the state in helping us to look at ways to improve the services of the court in juvenile cases and providing training, which is important not only to judges but to lawyers and other participants in the system. And I would urge you to approve the Chief Justice's budget.
Thank you very much for that testimony, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Human Services, we have a proposal to add Attorney General support for DHS, for representation of DHS in dependency hearings. Would your certainly your advice to us, or in terms of whether that's would be helpful, whether it would speed court procedures, what do you see it as something that is either necessary or unnecessary or helpful or whatever, if you'd like to comment on that and get right in the middle of the battle right now?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hansen, we did testify at that hearing, and our position at that hearing was that we were concerned that the AG package was being funded out of some fairly obvious cuts to foster care funding, to the Flex Funds funding, and some other child welfare funding, that we couldn't support the cuts. But we do support the notion that we need to have representation for caseworkers in juvenile court proceedings, and we believe that it is a disadvantage to the state to not have that representation. I think that at this point, because we know that the package only represents a 10% increase in the amount of representation that would be provided, that it would be better to have some more planning and a better proposal, in essence, that involves the district attorneys more. Mr. Begla is here, so you can ask him that question, too. In what ultimately the system of representation of the state ought to look like.
Thank you very much. Tim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley, members of the subcommittee. My name is Sybil Hibb, and I am appearing today on behalf of the low-income clients of the Oregon Law Center in support of the Judicial Department's budget. As you know, the Law Center is a statewide civil legal services provider, and we provide free services to people who are within 125% of the federal poverty level. So the services that we provide are to people, to families and to individuals who are the state's neediest families, and they generally are unable to afford private legal counsel, and without our services they are forced to go to the courts without assistance at all. So because we think our clients are representative of some of the neediest people in Oregon, we're here today to talk about the ways in which the courts can effectively provide an access to justice for that population. Our clients are generally faced with a variety of legal matters, and generally speaking, poverty has exacerbated the situations that they're in, such that they face many times multiple legal issues, and for a variety of reasons they are unable to effectively handle these cases in court by themselves without the assistance of counsel. We try to prioritize the cases that involve the most serious and most crucial issues, such as personal safety and security, shelter, those very crucial human needs. And so it's from that perspective that I speak today. We're supportive of funding at full levels for the Judicial Department, because if courts are not fully staffed and fully available and accessible, then we're essentially, as legal services advocates, unable to effectively help our clients achieve safety or shelter, whatever the case may be. Many of our clients, just to give an example, are victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and elder abuse, and these are very much the personal safety issues that require immediate assistance that we prioritize. They are in need of immediate assistance, but as well they are in need of longer-term protections that will enable them to put a stop to the cycle and have a hope of stepping out into a world of safety, as opposed to a repeated need to access immediate and emergency assistance. We think these victims who are the most vulnerable are perhaps in the most need of the court's availability. And just to provide some context, we have we've seen studies that have shown that when victims in these safety circumstances take a step towards safety, take a step towards reaching out, whether it's through the courts or in other methods, when they take those steps, they actually, ironically, put themselves at risk of greater danger. That is, the greatest safety risk that a victim faces is taking those steps, and the risk of homicide is, I think, 18 times greater than previously, and I have some written testimony that cites the study that shows that, so I'll be happy to provide that. And so when that victim is ready to take a step forward to seek safety, it's really essential that there be a reliable system in place that will allow him or her to move forward. And the court is, of course, a place that allows victims to seek immediate relief in the form of family abuse prevention orders or stalking protection orders, just to name a couple of examples. And we have also seen recently that there are and I think this is hopeful evidence, that there are studies that have shown that the provision of civil legal assistance in an effective manner through the courts has actually led to the reduction of further domestic violence. And so it's one of the few things that studies have been able to point to say, if this is available, if this is accessible, the overall violence in the community goes down. And as in my practice as a family law attorney in previous years and through the experiences of my colleagues throughout the state, I think we have seen over the years an increasing level of severity of violence, an increasing level of complexity, especially with the involvement, unfortunately, of the methamphetamine epidemic throughout the state. The cases have become more complicated and more difficult. It's more important that there be a coordinated response in the court system between both the civil legal protection system as well as the criminal prosecution system, as well as the drug court system, as well as the juvenile protection order system. And so I really appreciate this committee's looking at and appreciating the value of having that overall larger picture assessed, and appreciate your continued dedication to ensuring that these services are available to victims in need. Last year, as I think we heard before, we appreciated the court's prioritization of immediate safety services for victims, even in the face of severe budget cuts, and that was a help. However, the budget cuts necessarily reduced the availability of some of the longer-term protection that was necessary for our clients, and we saw that because it was harder to move through, for example, the domestic relations docket for divorce and long-term safe parenting plans, we saw that impact on our clients, and that created, I think, a greater period of conflict for families. So I just want to thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. I'd also like to take the opportunity to thank you for your service on the Senate President's Task Force, which met during the interim, focused on parental abduction. Your contribution there was really wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Ms. McFarland, thank you for your presentation again. And, Judge, it really is encouraging to hear the kind of success you're having with the mental health court over in Deschutes County. That's something that is very important to me and something that I'll be paying close attention to in the weeks and months ahead. So just want to encourage you with your efforts out there.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Moving on to the next panel, and we really appreciate the folks who have gathered this afternoon to help us gain a fuller understanding of the courts and the importance of this branch. So thank you for taking time out to be here. The Honorable Robert Herndon from Clackamas County, the Honorable Randy Garrison from Douglas County, and Walt Wow from Marion County. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Senator Gordley, and members of the committee and staff. I'm Robert Herndon, Circuit Court Judge from Clackamas County, one of those people that's I guess in the delivery of services in our line of work, and it's a pleasure to be here. Nancy told us that we needed to talk fast, so that's probably good news for you. I'm sure that everyone is certainly in favor of law and order, and this is the downside to it. It all has to be funded, and I think the common notion is oftentimes is that judges are liberal and they want to turn people loose, and as Judge Wolheim said, I think collectively judges are really quite a conservative group, and if you were to go to the judicial conference and be standing around, you'd hear the judges talk about their frustration with where we are. and what we let happen to the system the last time when we had to close the courts on Fridays. There's a lot of people who still come up to me and ask, gee, it's a pretty good job you've got. You don't work on Fridays. They still think we're not open on Fridays, even though the judges were still working during that period of time. But I want to just express, as a deliverer of service, our frustration of our inability to do our job. You know, we just do not have the personnel. We don't have the judges. We don't have the jail space. All of those things are certainly not on your agenda, but they seriously hamper our ability to do our job. And I think statewide we're doing a good job with locking up the really dangerous people. But we're not doing a good job of getting a handle on the people who really interfere with the quality of life that we have. Those people that are breaking into our cars, that are doing identity theft, that are breaking into your garage, that, you know, all those kinds of things that go on and on. And the lack of judges that we have seriously impairs our ability to do that, the lack of jail space. When I see a new bill that's passed for new minimum sentences for somebody, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, because it just means that somebody else is going to be turned loose. I've got somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 people. I've been a circuit court judge for just a few weeks short of 8 years. Somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 people on bench probation. You shouldn't be impressed by that. That's not good news, because bench probation is essentially no probation. Those are people who are going to have to be rearrested. Those are people who are going to have another lawyer appointed for them, who are going to take up valuable court time to adjudicate their case once again. And while that goes on, we're not able to do civil cases that need to be heard. People who have custody matters, people who are not getting their child support, things like that that have to wait months and months. In Clackamas County, we're setting those cases over time and again. And we finally get them to a hearing. And even though we double, triple, quadruple set every judge with hearings, those cases at the end of the food chain, unless we have more help, the system is going to be in serious disrepair, and it's going to affect the quality of life that we all have. So that's the message that I want to bring to you from a trial court, certainly in a fairly large metropolitan county, that my staff and I are, when we're working into the lunch hour pretty routinely, we're starting cases that are scheduled for 1:30 at 4:30. I've developed bladder control beyond your belief, bailiff, she says, I thought you old guys had to go to the bathroom a lot, but I proved her wrong on that, and it's not the situation I like to be in. So I'd like to pass it on to Judge Garrison to share his perspective from a downstate county.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge
Herndon. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Nancy Miller saw the 18 pages of notes I had to give to you today and said, make it brief, Garrison. And so I listened to Judge Brewer wax philosophically about our president, the Russian president, and democracy, and I had a bunch of philosophical comments to make about trust and confidence in the judicial system and in government generally and how important that is. And so I threw those away. And I heard Judge Wolheim about the rule of law and opportunity to be heard and how important that was. And I thought that is a very important thing and the most important thing in my courtroom. And so I threw those notes away. And I heard Judge Tickton talk about drug court and mental health court and family court and the wonderful programs that he has in Deschutes County. And I threw the rest of my notes away because I thought his comments were very helpful to you. And I thought, how can I be helpful in saying something to you folks? And so having thrown away all my notes, I just decided that I wanted to speak to you from my heart. There's only a couple of you here. Let's just have a real conversation for a moment, can we? I've been a judge for 4 months, just elected. Bruce Hill and I are both from Douglas County. We saw each other on a regular basis because our campaigns were at the same time. Have a lot of respect for Mr. Hanna. And as I tell you about my court, I handle 90% civil cases, 10% criminal cases. So I don't have a lot of experience to share on this criminal aspect except one thing, and that is every day in my courtroom, on average, there's a methamphetamine case. That breaks my heart. I don't know what to do with it. I'm frustrated. This judge talked about frustration among judges. It's a terrible problem. I know it's been the subject of legislative scrutiny a great deal. I know that you have tried to deal with it. I'm not sure I can say anything particularly more helpful except this, and that is I enjoy and hope to maintain and continue to have a wide variety of tools to deal with the methamphetamine problem. My business friends and I, before I became a judge, I was a lawyer for 28 years and a member of the Chamber of Commerce and member of the City Council and had substantial business clients. And my business folks, my business friends are telling me that it's wreaking havoc with business. We can't find people to be employed because of drug test problems. In fact, there are employers that are beginning to tell me, don't make me give drug tests because I can't find people to work. It's a problem of great proportions. When I review court-appointed affidavits for attorneys to be appointed, many times the sole source of income is unemployment of people that have been accused of drug crimes and particularly methamphetamine crimes. And so I have sentenced people to jail for methamphetamine. I had a five-time user. He had a methamphetamine charge once every year for the last 5 years, and I just decided it's time for you to go to the penitentiary. I have had first-time users that I have said, why don't you want to go into a treatment program? Our particular drug program in Douglas County does not allow in it manufacture or sale people. You got to have possession only, which I think we need to talk about and discuss more, because all you have to have a manufacturer of methamphetamine is to cook a little batch up in your own house and go sell it for $15 to your friend, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, your drug pusher. And that gets you, that disqualifies you from drug court. I think we need to look at that some more. We put people on probation. Some people are amenable to probation. I have sat there in court and irritated both the defense bar and the prosecutors by saying, I don't know why we are wasting resources on some of these people, because they're just going to go abuse again. Let's give them a jail sentence and tell them they paid their debt to society and then have them come back on their next drug charge. The most successful program that I want to share with you that we have in Douglas County is not from state funding, but from a federal grant. It's called the RSAT program. And what happens is a person is sentenced to the Douglas County Jail a minimum of 270 days. There is an intensive six-month residential in-house in-jail treatment program where these folks learn how to get new friends, learn to get off drugs. It's not an easy thing to get away from addiction. It takes a six-month program in a jail. It is the most successful program that we have. And when I can get people into that program through sentencing, I'm happy, because it is the most successful program that we have. And it has an aftercare component, too. We have probation officers that have people report twice a week to them, regular UAs, and help find them housing and make sure that they've outside friends are not their old friends, but new friends. Help them with employment opportunities. So what do I have to share from with my heart after 4 months on the bench is that the judicial system plays a crucial role in monitoring this very huge problem in our society, and I hope that we have the resources to continue to have a variety of things that we can do to meet this drug problem that we have that we're also very concerned about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Judge Garrison. The federal program that you refer to is titled
RSAT, R-S-A-T. And if you're going to ask me, I've asked a couple of times what that stands for, and I have to be reminded each time. It's Residential Substance Abuse Treatment Program, RSAT.
Okay, and that program has been in existence for how long?
At least a year in Douglas County. I'm a newbie, so I can't go further back and give you a good representation on how long it's been there.
Okay, I would be interested in understanding what makes the program successful,
the length of time, the being within a closed confined setting so that drugs are not accessible and falling off the wagon isn't there, and then the aftercare treatment program of finding housing, finding jobs, and the real supervision and monitoring that goes on by probation officers afterwards.
So
those are the successful components.
Do we have enough experience with the program to look at recidivism rates?
I believe I can't quote you chapter and verse and recidivism rates. If you'd like me to get you that information, I'd be more than happy to do so. And anecdotally, I can tell you that I believe recidivism is low because the addiction issues are treated, the who you hang out issues are treated, and the aftercare treatment is crucial.
Would be very interested to look at any data that you have.
I'll get your email address through the directories and send you some information on that. Thank you for
the committee, if you would. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I can give him my email address and take care of distributing it to the committee.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Again.
Members of the committee, my name is Walt Biglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney. I'm here to offer my broad support for this budget of the Oregon Judicial Department. I think the fact that I'm side by side with the judges is very symbolic of my support. I'm usually looking up to the judges in the courtroom. If I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. In public safety, nothing is more important than recognizing that it is a system comprised of valuable partners. The judicial branch and the court administration is an integral part of the delivery of public safety. And in fact, a healthy public safety system relies on a balanced approach to policy and practice and resource allocation. In Marion County, we have embraced this relationship. Day to day, we are committed to an effective and efficient use of time and money. In fact, the district attorney, the court, the defense association, law enforcement, court officials meet monthly to round table the collective efforts to deliver the business of public safety day to day through our correctional facility. Again, in Marion County, all our partners participate in a program called Early Disposition Programs. It's mandated by statute, a process that's designed to effect an efficient and fair resolution of criminal cases, easing the volume, the sheer volume of cases the judges are seeing, and reducing the cost. In addition, I would highlight, and I know Justice Brewer talked about service delivery, improving that. In our county, we have an active willingness to participate and promote opportunities between the public safety system and our community. And Judge Lipskin and myself and Judge Abernathy and the business community have focused on bridging that effort with foster care and the burgeoning number of children that are coming out of the system and into foster care. And I think it's a unique and exciting opportunity, and I think it's being replicated across the state, and we're doing that right now in our community. There is a constant communication on the court functions daily with the district attorney and the other partners. The courts and the administration play a vital role in the safety and security of our courthouses and other buildings where the public is doing their business. And I think that's a very vital piece. It's been mentioned more than once today, the drug courts. The model that we utilize in Marion County is a collaborative effort. And the judges' comments about their program there to measure its success resound in the way we operate our drug court here. And in fact, we're going to showcase our drug court here on Friday. Honestly, if you want to see change in motion, if you want to see hope in people addicted to methamphetamine, quite frankly, if you want to bring tears to your eyes, you will look at the folks that are going through our programs and the efforts of the court and the other partners to try and tackle the crippling addiction of methamphetamine. And so I think that's a really important piece to highlight in terms of the relationship between all your public safety partners. Really, all this is to one end, and that's to serve the citizens of our county here in Marion County and the citizens of the state of Oregon. And I look forward as a district attorney to seek better solutions over time in a sustainable process. So it's a privilege to be here today to talk about this partnership, and I appreciate the time for you to listen to my comments.
Thank you very much. Comments or questions for the panel?
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to pass on to Senator Gordley that Steve Dole is home sick today and was going to be unable to join us, but I know his position on this was certainly well known to everyone.
We did get that word, and thank you very much for saying
thank
that for
again.
The record. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Peter Ozan, would you like to come up and wrap up this particular panel on public safety? And then we'll move to the sustaining business panel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Ozan. I'm Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Commission, and I was asked to provide views and support on behalf of the criminal defense community with regard to the courts. And there are two obvious functions that you're well aware of and the previous witnesses have testified to, and I would call those the adjudicative function of the courts, which obviously defense attorneys are interested in, having their clients receive fair, a speedy, and intelligent disposition of their cases, and the sentencing or dispositional stage, and of course many of the witnesses previous have talked about that, the importance to public safety of having knowledgeable, engaged, active judges who are looking at the array of sanctions in the community, encouraging the development of those, and then imposing them on people convicted for the sake of the community. And those are two key functions. I would like to briefly comment about a couple of perspectives perhaps the courts themselves wouldn't be able so comfortably to speak to. In my 30 years as a resident in Oregon, all of that time as a lawyer, I think the single most improved and innovative public agency as an institution in Oregon had been the courts. From a period of time in 1974 when I arrived, the courts, and of course they are a separate branch of government and have individual and unique business to do, but while there were many, many exceptions, the general view, in my opinion, was an agency of insular, let me do my work, don't bother me with the consequences, if you will. I'm there to sentence or to adjudicate, and that's my job. I think there's been great change, and you've seen it here today, in which the two functions I want to talk about today are, number one, guarantor of quality, and number two, leader in public policy and in the role of neutral convener. Let me talk first about the guarantor of quality. And I think it's essential to think about what I think is this 30 years, at least in my view, of steady and improved growth. And I ask myself when I see the experience of the courts last biennium, have we peaked out as one of the best court systems in the country, and are we going to go downhill now, or are we going to continue the growth in terms of the quality of the people who are judges and the staffing and the innovation that you've seen? And judges, I think, are central and guarantors of quality of public safety and criminal justice. Any lawyer who practices very long has, like you all do, your favorite school teachers. Well, your favorite or feared judge is the one that you know will not tolerate a poor quality lawyering, will not tolerate delay, will demand quality. And those judges are really, in my view, the most important ingredient in the public safety system, demanding quality in the performance of the lawyer, and demanding quality, by the way, in the kinds of sanctions and services that are available when they impose sentences. The second one, that, as I say, when I arrived, there wasn't much going on, and with the leadership of the current Chief Justice and many of the judges in the room today, is this notion of being a leader in policy. Again, the courts have to be separate. They are a separate branch of government. But in their role as members and sometimes chairs of the local public safety coordinating councils, as presiders or neutral conveners of the criminal justice advisory councils in every county in the state, they are really the leaders in public policy. Now, they may not drive public policy in their neutral role, but they bring people together. And believe me, it's the judge, the man and woman in that black robe, that gets people to show up at meetings and gets people to do things in these various functions. So that role of public policy leader and neutral convener is a critical one. When the commission, which, as you know from my testimony in our hearings, the Public Defense Services Commission is traveling around the state, going county to county and looking at the public defense delivery systems, and that's really our business. But when we go to these counties, we look at the entire functioning of the criminal justice system, and I should say the juvenile justice system, of course. I've been remiss in not including that equally important function, as well as civil commitment. When we look at these systems in the counties, we find the counties that are really functioning are the counties where there is active judicial leadership, where absent that kind of judicial leadership, you often find counties in which the lawyers aren't functioning very well together. Our lawyers aren't doing a very good job. They're not getting along with the district attorneys. They're not functioning effectively. And the very best counties is where there are active judicial leadership. So I would urge you again to support the budget, to continue this upward course that the judiciary has been on, at least in the 30 years I've been in the state. We cannot have a disruption of the services we had, in my view, last biennium, and continue to draw the quality of the men and women who serve as judges and in their staffs throughout the state if we have the kind of interruption of service and the kind of shortage of services that we've experienced recently. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Ozette. It's good to see you this afternoon. Thank you. Our final panel, Sustaining Business, the Honorable Paul Lipscomb, Marion County Judge. Good afternoon. Is it Matt Markey? Jim Markey. And Jim Martinez?
Jim's not here, sorry, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Julie Brandis?
Not here. Okay.
Good afternoon. I'm Paul Lipscomb. I'm the presiding judge in Marion County Circuit Court, and I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the importance of the courts in terms of sustaining business and economic development in Oregon and elsewhere. I think it's, and I'm going to be quick because we want to leave some time for the Chief Justice to wrap up here today. I think it's simply part of human nature that we sometimes take for granted that which is familiar to us, that which is customary and basic to our own individual lives, as well as the normal functioning of our social systems. We know in America and in Oregon that we have the strongest and most efficient economic system in the world, the free market system. We sometimes forget, however, that our brilliantly successful economic system, at least in comparison to all others, is based on the rule of law and is supported by an independent and energetic judiciary. Both judicial independence and the rule of law which supports it are essential to the social and economic development and the continuing economic growth of our societies. Judge Wolheim has already talked to you at length about social development, and I'm not going to repeat that. But I think we do sometimes take for granted the basic need for judicial independence and the rule of law, not just here, but elsewhere. Certainly they don't, though, in the former communist countries and in the developing nations of the world. I brought with me here today some quotes from both Alan Greenspan, who's chair of the Federal Reserve Board, and James Wolfenson, president of the World Bank, talking about an effective legal and judicial system being essential for long-term economic development. But in the interest of time today, I'm going to skip right over that and simply say that I think it's without question among economic theorists that without the rule of law, a community is likely to find itself at the mercy of the self-interested and powerful. Title to land will not be respected, freedom to conduct business without interference will not be achievable, and the simple movement of products safely from village to the city and from city to city is simply not possible. The same rules must be applied uniformly, and the same system must be applied to all, if our economic market-driven system is to work. For me, the personal enlightenment came with a trip to Buenos Aires about 6 or 8 years ago when my daughter was an exchange student down there in college. I was already 10 years a judge at that point, but I really never understood in an impactful way until I was in Buenos Aires how important the independence of our judiciary is to the economic development of a country. And that awareness came to me amid really a struggling economic environment in Buenos Aires at the time, gross inflation, etc., rampant corruption throughout government and business. There was a series of articles in the Buenos Aires Times, which is the English paper down there, it culminated in an editorial that basically said that no matter what else was done, it would all fail without an independent judiciary. They could have all the reforms on paper that they wanted, but unless an independent judiciary was there to sustain those reforms, there would be no foreign and domestic investors attracted to put their capital at risk in that country. The consistent application of the rule of law is simply essential and necessary. The same rules have to apply to all parties, and courts cannot be susceptible to political influence when making their determinations. The American judicial system is widely being copied now by former Soviet and communist bloc countries as they develop their market-based economy. Court reform is now underway in the Balkan republics, in Egypt, in Russia, in Latin America, and in Asia. Personally, I've participated in working with Russian judges who have traveled to the United States and to Oregon who are interested in replicating our judicial system to support the economic development and continued business success and growth in their country. It's important to understand that judicial independence doesn't exist for the courts and for the judges, but it exists for the people, and to support the people in the conduct of their business and the protection of their property interests and their economic and other freedoms. The existence of independent courts is necessary and essential, but alone it's not enough, it's not sufficient. The services must be readily available, and access to justice must be obtainable in a timely and user-friendly fashion, both on the civil side and the criminal side. Our modern courts, and I thank Peter Ozan for his comments, but our courts are different today than they used to be. In our modern courts, customer service orientation is a maxim that we pursue every day. We try ever harder to be more and more user-friendly. In the business setting, this is reflected in settlement conferences, which lead to earlier resolution of business disputes, early response with temporary restraining orders and injunctions when necessary to stave off business disputes at an early time, expedited small claims cases when we're fully funded to get those out, expedited FED cases, the landlord-tenant disputes, so that personal property, business property, and real estate can be returned to the proper owner at the proper time. Early disposition practices in criminal courts are also important to sustain economic development and business growth. Property crimes, theft, and embezzlement matters are handled efficiently and at an early stage, so they're not drawn on and on. And finally, restitution needs to be ordered and enforced promptly. In essence, then, the prompt and efficient protection of private contracts and private property interests is essential to the continued growth of our economy, as it is with other economies in the world. And we need to resolve cases in accordance with the time standards set forth by the American Bar Association that we strive to meet when we can and when we've got the funds to go forward and do the kind of job that we're expected to do on behalf of our constituents. The interests of all must be properly and promptly protected without fear or favor and without discouraging barriers to the access to justice. And also, and finally, I should note that government excesses from time to time have to be restricted so that personal and individual property rights and freedoms are not unduly impaired. That brings me to a close. Thank you for your time and your attention here today.
Judge Lipscomb, thank you very much for your time and for your presentation. We appreciate you being here very much. And Chief, would you come on up? And I'm going to ask you to be ready to do your wrap-up right after we hear from Mr. Marquis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Marquis, and I'm here representing the American Collectors Association, the Mortgage Lenders Association, and other business clients that I represent that are heavy users of the court system. I just want to say that our court system is very well run in this state, and it's amazing to me that we're able to move some 140,000 civil cases through this system every year. And over half of those cases, roughly, 70,000 cases a year, are small claims cases. Many of our clients are involved in many of those small claims cases, often acting as a creditor trying to enforce a legitimate debt owed to a small business in Oregon and other types of things. The court system has to prioritize what it does. And when you compare any one of those small claims actions to an aggravated murder case or to some other thing of great importance that Chief Justice Carson and his people have to do, they pale by comparison. But when added together, those 70,000 cases are absolutely essential for Main Street Oregon to continue to do business in the way that they do it. And I want to say that the Chief Justice and his people have bent over backwards in times of dire straits here recently when they didn't have the money to do everything they needed to do to keep the doors to those courts open, those small claims cases, keep them moving through. And the judges have been helpful, but let's not forget the clerical staff. Oftentimes these small claims cases don't even rise to a hearing level. And the clerical staff in those courthouses are moving those cases through. And I want to really thank the Chief Justice for his cooperation the last few years in keeping these things moving through for us. It's been very helpful to us, certainly. And I do want to say that we don't always agree with everything at the Judicial Department, but where we can, we work together. And when they disagree with us, they do so respectfully, and we appreciate that as well. So with that, I'll turn it back to the Chief Justice and let him wrap up for you.
We appreciate you being here and your comments. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, Wally Carson, Chief Justice, we are finished with our presentation. I want to thank the committee again for your patience and your understanding and your working with us. It has, again, been a delight. I also want to thank all those people that testified yesterday and today on behalf of our judicial branch. Perhaps a near closing remark would be to invite you or respectfully to consider what we now call our recommended budget. You heard first our maintenance level budget, and now you've heard some of our other budget that we'd like you to consider. Please, we'll end where we started yesterday, and that is, courts are the backbone of our democracy, in our opinion. I'll quote from what's become kind of our mantra for some of our work that we're doing, and it kind of speaks to what you heard today particularly, but also the last 2 days, and it was coined by Judge Lipscomb several years ago, and that is, strong courts build strong communities. I would add to it, the reverse is also true. Weak courts build weak communities. Thank you for your attention, and we are fini.
Thank you very much, Chief Carson. And thank you again to all of you who came to participate in this presentation and, again, to help our fuller understanding of the issues facing the judicial system. Thank you very much. Anything for the good of the order?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did have the Judicial Department on the agenda for tomorrow because we have completed for today that should be the hearing for tomorrow for the Judicial Department should be canceled, you do still have the Homeland Security Department on your agenda for tomorrow.
All right, very good. All right. Without other comments, then, we are adjourned.